10 days that shook the world. Without exaggeration, Berkman wrote, I may say that the happiest day of my existence was passed in a prison cell, the day when the first news of the October Revolution and the victory of the Bolsheviki reached me in the Atlanta Federal Penitentiary. The Russian Civil War had begun. Just like the United States, what would become the Soviet Union was a country founded on a conscious philosophy. While America was based on the classical liberal principles of a property society, largely free from state interference, Lenin's Russia was to be a nation where virtually all of society was to be managed by the government in the name of equality and for the total benefit of all. In those early days, everything was on the table. It was a perfect inversion of G.K. Chesterton's fence. Chesterton had argued that if one came upon a fence crossing the road, it must have been put there for some reason at some point. It's perfectly possible that the reason no longer existed. But until one knew what that reason had been, one should err on the side of maintaining structures which had once served some purpose. They might still be performing some function not entirely apparent. In the same way that modern art experimented with abolishing perspective and realism in color and form, the new Russia was intended to entirely remake society and even the nature of man himself. By 1918, the Bolsheviks' code on marriage, the family, and guardianship envisioned a withering away of the family itself at some point in the future. Preferring one's children over others smacked of bourgeois values and inequality, both between families and within the family itself. No parent could do as good of a job educating their children as the government could. Indeed, it made perfect sense. The same government was going to educate, if not re-educate, the entire adult population as well. Love for one's children was narrow and irrational, which state educators were not. Why not speculate about a world where women gave birth, returned to the workforce, and had their children raised in a colony by caretakers far better trained in child-rearing than their birth mothers ever were? This would immediately solve the unfair situation of some children having bad parents. Assurances were made that in this more equal future, the mother would, of course, be able to see her child if and when she wanted. She only has to say the word. The newfound Bolshevik approach was encapsulated in arguing, as the dean of the Department of Law at Moscow State University later did, that we should not aspire to a highly stable family and look at marriage from that angle. Strengthening marriage in the family, making divorce more difficult, is not new, it is old. It is the same as bourgeois law. It wouldn't be much of a revolution if everyone simply did things the way grandma did. If things were old, they were therefore inherently in need of being undone in this new society of the future. Not only was the biology of the family open to discussion, but so was the biology of man himself. One communist writer mused that, we do not know whether, during communism, emotions will disappear, whether the human being will change to such an extent that he will become a luminous globe consisting of the head and brain only, or whether new and transformed emotions will come into being. All this was, of course, some time away, and they would eventually experiment with a new calendar, too, with a five-day week. The first Bolshevik reforms were far more modest than turning people into globes, but still entirely radical in their approach, eventually decreeing that all private property was nationalized by the government, all Russian banks were nationalized, private bank accounts were expropriated. The properties of the Russian Orthodox Church, including bank accounts, were expropriated. All foreign debts were repudiated. Control of the factories was given to the Soviets. An increase in wages and an 8-hour working day. Yet proclaiming a new government and actually governing were two entirely separate situations. Extraordinary times called for extraordinary measures. Lenin had explicitly asked how a revolution could be made without executions. In this, he might have been technically correct. It had given George Washington no pleasure to preside over the hanging of turncoat John Andrei, for example. But Lenin envisioned his dictatorship of the proletariat as one maintained through violence and a power unbound by laws. On December 19, 1917, mere weeks after seizing power in the October Revolution, Lenin issued a decree to form an extraordinary commission, Chervichaynaya Komissiya in Russian, or Cheka for short, for combating counter-revolution and sabotage. What made the Cheka so extraordinary was that it was, just as Lenin said, a secret police with power unbound by laws and superior to them. It was tasked with the power to persecute and break up all acts of counter-revolution and sabotage all over Russia. And since the revolution was defined as being embodied by the Bolshevik government itself, any opposition to it could thereby quite logically be claimed to be an act of counter-revolution and or sabotage. The Cheka took their work quite seriously, working in some ways independently of Lenin, but not shying away from shedding blood in achieving its goals. The Cheka is not a court, the head of the Cheka publicly stated in 1918. We stand for organized terror. This should be frankly admitted. The Cheka is obligated to defend the revolution and conquer the enemy, even if its sword does by chance sometimes fall upon the heads of the innocent. Nor was this new secret police particularly secret about its activities. If anything, its brazen superiority to the legal system was a testament to its power and a reminder of the relative powerlessness of the Russian people. The Bolsheviks' other major priority, however, was to get Russia out of the Great War. Communism was meant to to be a worldwide class revolution, not simply a Russian experiment, and warring with Germany was certainly antithetical to that goal, and to the goal of Lenin gaining greater power. At first, the Bolsheviks had teamed up with several other leftist movements in order to implement and stabilize the newfound socialist structure. Their primary rivals were the Mensheviks. Bolshe, being Russian for greater, and Mensha, meaning fewer, a supposed reflection on the relative popularity of the two groups. Whereas the Bolsheviks favored one-party rule and rapid social change, the Mensheviks leaned more toward political pluralism and an incremental approach. In addition, there were the Social Revolutionists, aka the Left SRs, a party with an agrarian base who believed in democratic socialism. Finally, and in no small number, there were Alexander Berkman and Emma Goldman's comrades, the anarchists. The factions were united against the remaining White Army, those forces still loyal to the Tsar who were endangering the success of the revolution. In December 1917, Trotsky, as foreign minister, sent Bolshevik agents to the Belarusian town of Brest-Litovsk to negotiate with the Germans. Thinking that the October Revolution would soon cause the workers of the world to unite and lose their chains, Lenin's instructions were simple. String out the talks until there's a revolution in Germany or as long as possible. Trotsky did his best to run out the clock, but the German offer was simple too. Germany would get to keep the lands it was in occupation of, namely Poland, Lithuania, Courland, and most of Western Ukraine. The terms were humiliating, and Lenin's comrades in government were having none of it. Lenin was unsure of what to do, or rather unsure of what he could get away with. Finally, on February 9th, 1918, German General Hoffmann offered an ultimatum. The Russians had one day to sign the treaty, or else Germany would invade. Trotsky had an unprecedented response. He said that Russia was leaving the war, but he also refused to sign a treaty to that effect. The Germans did not quite know what to make of this, or the Russians in general, one might add. The Russians dawdled again. The Germans threatened again. Finally, their patience ran out. In late February, they invaded, and in doing so, captured more territory in 3 days than they had in the previous 3 years combined. Capturing Petrograd was no longer an impossibility, and if the Germans captured Petrograd, it really would be the end of the Russian Revolution, if not Russia herself. Lenin managed to convince his comrades that they need to sign the treaty, but General Hoffmann was no fool either. As Sebastian put it, apart from the territory they had already lost, they were forced to give up the Baltic states, Finland, and nearly all Ukraine to the Central Powers, and the ports of Kars, Andalan, and Batum to the Turks. 1.8 million square kilometers, 62 million people, around 32% of its best agricultural land, 54% of its industry, and 89% of its coal mines. This was in addition to an indemnity of 120 million gold rubles. It was devastating and it was humiliating. Lenin was denounced as a German spy and a traitor. Karl Radek had traveled with Lenin on his sealed train, but now snarled that if we had 500 courageous men in Petrograd, we would put you in prison. Some people may indeed go to prison after this, Lenin replied, chillingly and prophetically, but if you will calculate the probabilities, you will see it is much more likely that I will send you rather than you send me. Though the cost was extraordinary, it bought Lenin more time to let the revolution develop. Further, it established him, and to a lesser extent Trotsky, as the person who was in a position to speak for Russia. Lenin had seized power in 1917 under the slogan of "All Power to the Soviets," meaning the workers' councils who would supposedly be making decisions nationwide. But soon Lenin was saying that all this sentimentality and prattle about democracy has to be cast overboard. By 1918, rival political parties who had supported Lenin's Bolsheviks in their seizure of power began to be made illegal. All power to the Soviets quickly became all power to the Bolsheviks. Lenin apparently never did say the quote that is often ascribed to him, "The capitalists will sell us the rope with which we will hang them." What he actually said was far less pithy and far worse. In his view, Bolshevism was a social system based on bloodletting, and the blood flowed from the beginning. "This is the hour of truth," Lenin wrote to a comrade in July of 1918. "It is of supreme importance that we encourage and make use of the energy of mass terror directed against the counter-revolutionaries." It was mere weeks after Lenin's letter when his own blood would be spilled, for there was an attempt on his life on August 30, 1918. A young woman from a rival political party managed to shoot him 3 times, causing injuries from which he would never fully recover. Yet the biggest victim of Lenin's shooting was the Russian population, for this gave the Bolsheviks a pretext to unleash the Red Terror. On September 1st, 1918, one newspaper urged vengeance. "We will turn our hearts into steel, which we will temper in the fire of suffering and the blood of fighters for freedom. We will make our hearts cruel, hard, and immovable, so that no mercy will enter them, and so that they will not quiver at the sight of a sea of enemy blood. We will let loose the floodgates of that sea. Without mercy, without sparing, we will kill our enemies in scores of hundreds. Let them be thousands, let them drown themselves in their own blood." As one prominent Cheka operative advised, don't seek for incriminating evidence as to whether the prisoners took part by deed or word in a rebellion against the Soviet government. You have to ask him what class he belongs to, what is his origin, his education, and profession. It is those questions that should decide the fate of the defendant, and therein lies the meaning of the Red Terror. Even Lenin thought that was going too far, but such concerns did little to stem the flow of blood. Less than a week after the assassination attempt came a declaration in Moscow from the war commissar. The working class of Soviet Russia arose, threateningly declaring that for every drop of proletarian blood, it will shed torrents of blood of those who go against the revolution, against the Soviets and proletarian leaders. For every proletarian life, it will seek to destroy the scions of bourgeois families and white guardists. From now on, the working class declares to its enemies that every single act of white terror will be answered with a ruthless proletarian mass terror. Terror and class warfare became official state policy. Enough of this long, sterile, and vain talk about Red Terror, opined the weekly Cheka in September 1918. It is time, while it is not late yet, to carry out, by deed and not in word, a ruthless and strictly organized mass terror. Bourgeois concepts like privacy and individualism were anathema, and the population itself was recruited to become an extension of the surveillance state. A 1918 commissar's order spelled out what this meant in practice when he sought to flush out targets from the citizenry. In case the guilty ones are not turned over to the authorities, one person out of 10 will be shot, irrespective whether he is guilty or not. Lenin was not unique in using the police to impose his will in the citizenry. Woodrow Wilson's idea of sending Americans to fight European battles was an inversion of the well-established Monroe Doctrine. It took until Teddy Roosevelt for a president to leave the United States while in office, and even then it was only to check in on progress in the Panama Canal and to tour America's new protectorate of Puerto Rico. Socialists in America were strongly opposed to entering the Great War. For Goldman and Berkman, the entire situation was absolute madness, government at its lowest and most evil. The various heads of state at war included the King of Italy, the Tsar of Russia, the German Kaiser, the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire, and Franz Joseph, who was both an emperor and a king. This is who the working classes should give their lives for? Men without a pot to piss in should die so that sultans and kings maintain their hold on power? At least Carnegie had been producing something of value in his mills. The Socialist Party in Philadelphia printed and mailed flyers to young men who were about to be drafted into war. Under the heading of Long Live the Constitution of the United States, the subhead included the text of the 13th Amendment, which forever made involuntary servitude illegal in America. When you conscript a man and compel him to go abroad to fight against his will, the flyer asserted, you violate the most sacred right of personal liberty and substitute for it what Daniel Webster called despotism in its worst form. If you do not assert and support your rights, you are helping to deny or disparage rights, which it is the solemn duty of all citizens and residents of the United States to retain. As far as anti-military pamphleteering went, this was as mild as it got. But even such a pamphlet was considered too dangerous to be allowed circulation. The party's general secretary, Charles Schenck, was sentenced to prison, with the case going all the way up to the Supreme Court. If anything was to be protected by the First Amendment, then surely it would be political speech such as this, except that it wasn't. The membership of the court at the time consisted of 3 Taft appointees, 2 from Roosevelt, 1 from McKinley, and 3 from Wilson. The court recognized that, in many places and in ordinary times, the defendants, in saying all that was said in the circular, would have been within their constitutional rights. But the character of every act depends on the circumstances in which it is done. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech, but in a unanimous decision, the court upheld the Espionage Act and its blatant assault on principles of free speech. In the sort of mental gymnastics only a legal mind could present with a straight face, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. compared the pamphleteering to causing a riot. The most stringent protection of free speech would not protect a man in falsely shouting fire in a theater and causing a panic. To begin with, theaters are private property, and therefore there's no right to yell anything in any theater at any time, any more than a person could wander into a radio station and start broadcasting from its microphones. But even presuming Holmes's point that yelling fire would cause people to get trampled, the consequences of such yelling would be immediate and direct. Nothing in Schenck's pamphlet would cause people to get worked up and riot. If anything, it called for them to calmly and methodically think through their rights as free men and to act accordingly in the name of minimizing death. It would have been no surprise to anarchists that in the Supreme Court there was a bipartisan, unanimous consensus in favor of the powers of the government and against the rights of the individual citizen. Tensions began to escalate. In 1918, 55 radicals were deported from the United States, but the United States government deported the wrong ones. April of 1918 saw over 30 letter bombs being mailed to various government officials and other powerful people, with the apparent intention that they would be delivered and opened on May 1st, May Day. The bombs were all packaged similarly, and after one exploded, blowing off the hands of a senator's housekeeper as well as his wife's teeth, the others were thereupon intercepted. The violence then increased. 9 bombs were detonated across 8 cities on June 2nd, but only managed to kill 1 night watchman. Most concerning was the bomb meant for Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer, which detonated prematurely in front of his Washington, D.C. townhouse. The explosive took out its young anarchist carrier as Assistant Secretary of the Navy Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his wife Eleanor witnessed the aftermath from their home across the street, an aftermath that included a piece of the bomber's body landing on their doorstep. Attorney General Palmer naturally took action against these threats against the state and private citizens. Though only 24 years old, Palmer put Justice Department lawyer J. Edgar Hoover in charge of a series of raids designed to investigate and infiltrate the nests of radicalism that pervaded throughout the United States. Berkman and Goldman were, of course, natural and obvious targets for the Hoover dragnet and were arrested and imprisoned. So it was that on December 21st, 1918, 250 radicals were deported to Russia aboard the USAT Buford, with Berkman and Goldman among them. Hoover personally came to New York City to see the pair off. "Haven't I given you a square deal, Miss Goldman?" he asked. Goldman was 50 years old, Berkman 49. They had lived their entire adult lives in the United States and were departing to a country they wouldn't recognize. It was a country that no one could recognize, for there was no other country like it anywhere on Earth. The two were optimistic. "Landing in Russia was the most sublime day of my life," Berkman wrote. "Thus my pious old forefathers must have felt on first entering the Holy of Holies. A strong desire was upon me to kneel down and kiss the ground. Times were hard, desperately so, but the nation was still at war, and restrictions on liberties were somewhat to be expected. Lenin assured his comrades that things would liberalize and improve once the Civil War ended and the era of war communism drew to a close. Nevertheless, there remained widespread squalor and hunger. The White Army forces of the Tsar were not yet defeated, and an Allied blockade against the Bolsheviks made matters even more difficult. One couldn't expect to liberate the workers of the world without an enormous counterreaction, both domestically and abroad. Yet that didn't explain the brutal oppression Goldman and Berkman were both personally witness to, outdoing the worst oppressions of the Tsar by far. As bad as things were in the United States, people weren't being imprisoned in large numbers due to their political ideology. In Lenin's Russia, that was swiftly becoming the norm." Berkman did his best to square his anarchist views with what would become known as Marxism-Leninism, writing, "Since my early youth, revolution, social revolution, was the great hope and aim of my life. It signified to me the Messiah who was to deliver the world from brutality, injustice, and evil, and pave the way for a regenerated humanity of brotherhood, living in peace, liberty, and beauty. I knew that the Bolsheviki were Marxists, believers in a centralized state which I, an anarchist, deny in principle. But I placed the revolution above theories, and it seemed to me that the Bolsheviki did the same. They resolutely applied anarchist methods and tactics when the exigency of the situation demanded them. Had not Lenin himself frequently asserted that he and his followers were ultimately anarchists, that political power was to them but a temporary means of accomplishing the revolution? The state was gradually to die off, to disappear, as Engels had taught, because its functions would become unnecessary and obsolete. An anarchist had bombed the Bolsheviks' Moscow Committee building on September 25, 1919, a few months before Berkman and Goldman had arrived in Russia. The assault was denounced by anarchist leaders throughout the Soviet Union, but to little matter. Lenin unleashed the power of the Cheka, and hundreds were arrested and tried. Lenin personally assured Berkman that, "We do not persecute anarchists of ideas, but we will not tolerate armed resistance or agitation of that character." But as historian Paul Average pointed out, "Unfortunately for the ideological anarchists, the Cheka did not bother to run its prisoners through a catechism of anarchist doctrine before meting out retribution. The Haymarket martyrs had been regarded by socialists of all stripes as victims of an evil oppressive regime, innocents who had been killed simply for having unpopular anarchist ideas. Now, the Cheka was doing the same thing on a scale 100 times over and supposedly doing so in the name of a working class revolution. Liberty, Lenin told Berkman, is a luxury not to be permitted at the present stage of development. When the revolution is out of danger, external and domestic, then free speech might be indulged in." Insisting that enemies must be crushed and all power centralized in the communist state, Lenin admitted that, "In this process, the government is often compelled to resort to unpleasant means, but that is the imperative of the situation, from which there can be no shrinking. In the course of time, these methods will be abolished when they have become unnecessary." Goldman's stature was prominent enough within revolutionary circles that she too managed to arrange a meeting with Lenin. "Since my arrival, I found scores of anarchists in prison and their press suppressed," she said to him. "I explained that I could not think of working with the Soviet government so long as my comrades were in prison for opinion's sake." To his credit, perhaps, Lenin spoke frankly with the revolutionary anarchist. He bluntly told Goldman that free speech is, of course, a bourgeois notion. "There can be no free speech in a revolutionary period. We have the peasantry against us because we can give them nothing in return for their bread. We'll have them on our side when we have something to exchange. Then you could have all the free speech you want, but not now." Fine, in times of siege, there needed to be limits set in political discourse, but that didn't explain or justify the barbarism of Lenin's secret police. As Goldman recounted, corruption was rampant. It put in the shade the worst crimes of the Jacobins. The depravity of the Cheka was a matter of common knowledge. People were shot for slight offenses, while those who could afford to give bribes were freed even after they had been sentenced to death. It repeatedly happened that the rich relatives of